This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, September 11th, 2013. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, in the U.S., family members and officials mark the 2001 September 11th terrorist attacks with ceremonies and vigils. Thousands march in Chile to commemorate the 40-year anniversary of a U.S.-backed coup that ushered in nearly two decades of a brutal military rule. And as the NSA releases its own documents following a Freedom of Information Act lawsuit, we'll examine the massive surveillance state that emerged in the years following 9/11. Those stories and more coming up.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for FSRN. Today, an estimated 400,000 people joined a human chain in the Catalonia region of Spain in support of an independent state. The local government is gearing up for a controversial independence referendum next year to mark the 300-year anniversary of the region's military defeat at the hands of the French and Spanish. FSRN's Ona Vancorla reports from Barcelona.
In most polls, support for independence is slightly over 50%. And especially strong in rural areas where Catalan is the dominant language. Support for independence among young Catalans has been growing, pushed in part by the bad economic situation in Spain and the idea that Catalonia, the wealthiest region of the country, is contributing disproportionately to the economy. Mar and her family joined others linking hands near the Sagrada Familia Basilica in the center of Barcelona. She says language and cultural differences also have created friction.
We have little things in common with the rest of Spain. We have a different history, we have different way to think, different culture, everything is different. So I don't know why we are keeping together.
Protesters hung the red and yellow Catalonian flag from the iconic church. Earlier this week, news was leaked about ongoing secret talks towards a political compromise, but nothing solid has materialized. Ona Vancorla, FSRN, Barcelona.
The abrupt shift towards a diplomatic solution to the chemical weapons issue in Syria continued today after President Obama's major public address last night. Obama asked Congress to delay a vote on military action as the Russian-led push for the regime to voluntarily give up its chemical weapons gained momentum.
It's too early to tell whether this offer will succeed, and any agreement must verify that the Assad regime keeps its commitments. But this initiative has the potential to remove the threat of chemical weapons without the use of force.
Obama did not take the threat of military intervention off the table. Secretary of State John Kerry is scheduled to meet with Russian officials tomorrow to discuss next steps. Results issued this afternoon showed progressive Democrat Bill de Blasio won more than 40% of the vote last night in New York City's Democratic primary for mayor. Addressing supporters last night, he claimed victory and marked the anniversary of the 9/11 attacks on the Twin Towers.
New Yorkers left no one behind that day. No matter who they were, where they lived, or what their economic situation. That is the New York we know and love. And that is a way of life and a set of values we must rededicate ourselves to.
There still could be a runoff. Officials have to count thousands of paper ballots, and the election isn't expected to be called until later this week. In other election news, Colorado voters successfully recalled two Democratic state senators who voted for gun control legislation. The repercussions for efforts to limit firearms in the state are expected to be far-reaching, but what this could indicate for partisan politics is still unclear. FSRN's Jim Pullen has more.
Pro-gun groups framed the recall election of State Senate President John Morse and Senator Angela Giron as a referendum on gun control laws. Groups on both sides, notably the National Rifle Association and Mayors Against Illegal Guns, dumped millions of dollars into the elections. Although Democrats still will have unified control over the state government, Republicans want to use the recalls to invigorate the party. But Seth Maskett, a University of Denver political scientist, cautions that the races were too local to draw sweeping conclusions for 2014.
Next year's elections will not look that much like what happened yesterday. So just because someone was vulnerable in that doesn't mean other people in their party will be next year.
Earlier this year, Democrats passed a suite of gun laws, including limits on high-capacity magazines and tightened background checks for private gun sales. Jim Pullen, FSRN, Boulder.
The city of Richmond, California is one of the Bay Area's poorest communities, but its Green Party mayor has a plan to keep residents' homes from being foreclosed. Early this morning, city officials voted to move forward. FSRN's Cameron Jones reports.
Richmond city councilors voted to advance a proposal to use eminent domain to seize underwater mortgages from lenders and then work with an investor group to refinance so homeowners can better afford their payments.
We are stepping in to make a fix that both the federal government and the bank, the mortgage industry and the banks have not been able to do, or they've either been unwilling or unable.
During a contentious meeting, Mayor Gail McLaughlin advocated for homeowners. The council voted 4-3 to use the government's constitutional power to offer lenders fair market value for hundreds of homes where residents owe more than the property is worth. Many of these loans are remnants of the subprime mortgage crisis. The city would then take on the risk of refinancing and have local residents repay based on current market value. Although Richmond still has a lengthy process ahead before being able to implement the plan, several banks and investors have already filed suit. Cameron Jones, FSRN, Berkeley.
And that's headlines for FSRN. From Charlotte, North Carolina, I'm Jess Burns.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. Cities and towns across the country marked the 12th anniversary of the terrorist attacks of September 11, 2001. At the 9/11 Memorial in Manhattan, survivors, family members, and friends of those killed and elected officials gathered near the two large fountains built into the footprint of the former World Trade Center buildings. Bells rang at the same time of each of the four plane crashes at 8:46, 9:03, 9:37, and 10:03 a.m., followed by a moment of silence. Family members, many holding photographs of loved ones and fighting back tears, also participated in the annual reading of the names of those who were killed.
Neil J. Levy.
Robert G. LeBlanc.
Leon Labor.
Kenneth Charles Liddy.
And my beloved brother, Edward Joseph Lehman. Ed, you are a light in our lives and will always be remembered until we meet again. I love you.
And my son, David Prudencio Lemagne, Port Authority Police Officer, we all miss you. You have a new niece and a nephew, David and Bethany. They all love you.
In Washington, Congress members gathered on the steps of the Capitol this morning, and at the Pentagon, President Obama addressed members of the military and families of those who died.
It is an honor to be with you here again to remember the tragedy of 12 Septembers ago, to honor the greatness of all who responded, and to stand with those who still grieve, and to provide them some measure of comfort once more.
In Pennsylvania, family and community members gathered at the Garden of Reflection 9/11 Memorial to honor the passengers and crew of Flight 93. There will also be a Remembrance in Light ceremony this evening at the site in Bucks County, and other commemorations and events across the country. Today also marks the 40-year anniversary of the military coup in Chile, which ousted elected President Salvador Allende and ushered in the military dictatorship of Augusto Pinochet. General Pinochet's rule, which received ongoing support from the U.S., was marked by political killings and torturing of tens of thousands, disappearances, censorship of the media, suspension of civil rights, and other abuses. Today, Chileans around the world reflect on the implications this September 11th had in their lives. FSRN's Catalina Jaramillo brings us one survivor's story.
This is a story about a New Yorker on September 11th.
11 de septiembre de 1973.
José Mata was a 20-year-old student in Chile. He wanted to become a teacher.
I woke up around 7 o'clock in the morning. I was ready to go to school, to college. My aunts had the radio on, and there were really kind of worrisome news.
The news that morning were that the military was getting ready to attack the government house in Santiago called La Moneda. But President Salvador Allende still sounded calm.
I went to school like a regular day, although I have to say that in the back of my mind, and I saw people in the street, and there was a sense that something was going to happen. At around 11 o'clock in the morning, the first trucks with troops began parking in the street right in front of the college.
Tanks were outside the walls and things inside were heating up. José decided to leave. He was part of a leftist group, MAPU. They had already designated an emergency meeting point, so he went there, but only few members showed up. He started feeling worried.
We heard clearly the fighter jets, you know, of the Chilean Air Force that were on a bombing round. I didn't know what they were bombing, but as I was getting close to my house, people were saying that the Moneda Palace, you know, had been bombed. And you could see the smoke. The smoke could be seen from all over Santiago. And then the machine gun fire was like everywhere.
Augusto Pinochet led a military coup to overthrow President Allende. Allende gave his last speech from his presidential office. You can hear the bombs falling in the background. Pinochet had the support of the right and center wings, and the U.S. No one ever imagined he was going to stay for 17 years.
No one that day could have foresaw what was going to come. I mean, the horror, the repression, the torture, the incarceration of thousands of Chileans, the exile of hundreds of thousands of Chileans. That day, it was difficult to foresee.
José was not a prominent revolutionary. He was a student that sometimes did pacifist political work. He printed and distributed leaflets at his college.
I was arrested, in 1975, 2 years and a half after the coup d'etat. A patrol came at night. My parents, because they were somehow sympathetic to the dictatorship, this was at 3 o'clock in the morning during the curfew. My parents, you know, were kind of very gentle, very cordial with them. There were no beatings inside the house. Everything was very cordial. I remember that even my aunt offered them tea.
But the patrols weren't that gentle. They threw him blindfolded into a truck with another man. He remembers a strong smell of urine. That night, almost 30 students and clerks from his school were arrested. He didn't know where he was, why he was there, or what was going to happen to him. He says the worst thing was hearing the screams of others. Today, he can't really tell what was real and what he dreamt. One thing he remembers clearly, seeing diapers in the sink.
My God, they had babies in that place. I thought that I could hear little kids crying, but I thought that I was, you know, we were hearing things.
Nothing too bad happened to him. But he heard of people being tortured, women being raped, and electroshocks.
Many of my fellow political prisoners, I think most of them, had been subjected to many, many kinds of tortures.
José prefers to take the good things out of life. To him, life in the concentration camp was kind of normal. They had classes, a theater group, and he played a lot of football.
you know, we, the ones who were in prison, we were the only ones who were relatively free in Chile, because in the rest of the country, you know, nobody could speak, nobody could discuss politics, you know, nobody could stage progressive plays. We did it.
José Mata was never in front of a judge or formally accused. He was forced to sign a confession when he got to prison, and that was it. In May 1976, his captors informed him that he was being expelled from the country to the U.S. He was shocked.
I had a great life, and I always wanted to go back to my parents' house and continue my studies. That was really what I thought that it was going to happen to me.
Instead, he was taken from jail to the airport, and from there to Gainesville, Florida. He was in the U.S., the country that supported the coup. But in 3 weeks, he had a job, and he adapted easily. He moved to New York a year later. 8 years after that, he was allowed back in Chile, but he decided to stay here and become a citizen. 26 years ago, he got a job with the Healthcare Workers Trade Union, 1199 SEIU. Today, he runs an adult education program, he's politically active, and he's an officer in the COP he lives in. After all, everything turned out to be okay.
Looking back, I am glad because, you know, I made a life in the U.S., and I believe that I have contributed a lot to the U.S. And I have to say that, you know, after all these years, I really love this country. I love this country, I have to say.
Catalina Jaramillo, Free Speech Radio News, New York.
Voy a hacerme un cigarrito. ¿Acaso tengo tabaco? Si no tengo, ¿de dónde saco? Lo más cierto es que no pido.
The 40th anniversary of the U.S.-supported military coup in Chile has prompted protests and demonstrations throughout the country over the last few days. Today, crowds gathered in parts of the capital, Santiago, and some clashes erupted with police. Many protesters are calling for accountability and transparency for the crimes committed under General Pinochet. Crowds have drawn a forceful response from police, with security using water cannons and tear gas on Tuesday. For more, we're joined by journalist Jorge Garretón from Santiago, Chile. Hi, Jorge.
Hello, Dorian. Good to be here.
Begin by describing Santiago today. What are the streets like? What is the city like?
Santiago is like any normal day today, but there's tension in the air. There's a bit of tension in the air because of the importance of September 11th in Chile. There were some skirmishes in different points of Santiago by some anarchist groups that set up barricades in different parts of the city, and also in the more economically depressed areas, drug lords have set up barricades and they have shot at police. So, and there's this tension by people who do work through, who do sort of their normal daily life, and there's going to be a stampede later in this afternoon when people go home to work from work. Because fears of what could happen as the evening draws on and darkness takes over the city and takes over the country. In the past, there have been violent protests in different sectors of Chile, and there have been deaths of people that have been innocent bystanders of the protests. So people are very cautious in that sense.
So a tense atmosphere, some recent protests also. Now, the National Association of Judges has apologized formally for judges during the 70s and 80s under military rule, specifically for not pursuing accountability for abuse and killings. The Supreme Court also admitted it failed to protect victims of government-sponsored violence. Talk about the significance of these statements ahead of today's anniversary.
It's important that each segment of society, particularly one of the three powers of the state, admits its omissions, admits its errors, admits its failure to protect the rights of people. But we have to remember also that the Supreme Court up until the mid-1980s, denied there were human rights abuses taking place in Chile. They denied requests for protection by the courts. When asked to do so, writs of habeas corpus were constantly denied by the Supreme Court throughout most of the period of the dictatorship, until in the mid-1980s when judges, independent judges, began to investigate human rights violations.
So 4 decades after the coup, the Supreme Court has admitted some of those mistakes, some of those errors that you're describing in detail there. But the Supreme Court did stop short of an apology. Beyond symbolism, is there any legal or concrete action that could come from this?
I think we have to wait until the Supreme Court finally admits, asks for forgiveness. And the Supreme Court is not the only institution that should be asking for forgiveness. We know that the Army has asked for forgiveness a few years back. Nearly 10 years ago, the Army asked for forgiveness as it tries to eradicate the Pinochet era from its history, from its ranks. We have the Navy, the Chilean Navy, has never asked for forgiveness. The Air Force, which bombed with precision bombing the presidential palace and the presidential home in 2 points of Santiago, has never asked for forgiveness or for pardon for his actions. So there's still a long way to go for the Chilean institutions to ask for pardon and forgiveness for taking part in the coup, and at the same time for the human rights violations committed throughout the dictatorship.
Jorge Garretón in Santiago. We're talking about events in the 70s, also through the 80s. But as we've seen from Chileans who've come out into the streets over the weekend, also again today, they're highlighting some of the issues that are continuing today. Are there still families who do not know what happened to their loved ones during the military dictatorship?
According to records, that there's some 1,100 detained and disappear. And that is the biggest blight in the issue of human rights, because the family members do not know what happened to their loved ones. They're still in this legal limbo, as I mentioned, of being detained and disappeared. They do not know what happened to their family members. Justice has been done profoundly throughout Chile. Chile has done, perhaps of the countries that witness and suffer human rights violations, has done the most worldwide in terms of seeking justice and retribution to victims, but there's still a major sore point: the justice for the detained and disappeared. The truth and justice has not come to them. And until that is not resolved, what happened to the disappeared, Chile's wound will remain open. And also in terms of that, Chile is sort of in a period of change. We're moving to a new political and socioeconomic climate, away from neoliberal ideology to more egalitarian, more equal, a more equality-based, rights-based ideology of the majority of the people here in Chile.
That's journalist Jorge Garretón speaking to us from Santiago, Chile, on the 40-year anniversary of the U.S.-backed coup that ushered in the dictatorship of Augusto Pinochet. Thanks for speaking with us, Jorge.
Thank you.
The National Security Agency released hundreds of pages of formally classified documents yesterday in response to a Freedom of Information Act lawsuit. The documents reveal more widespread monitoring, constitutional violations, and acts of deception than previously known, and add to a growing debate about the use of surveillance tools and security after 9/11. In Washington, D.C., FSRN's Alice Olstein has more.
Following a more than 2-year-long legal battle, civil liberties advocates won access this week to information about how the executive branch has interpreted and used the controversial surveillance provisions of the Patriot Act. The government also released a number of legal opinions from the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court and several internal secret memos.
There are a number of disturbing revelations that came out of the documents. They show that the NSA has repeatedly violated court-imposed limits on its surveillance powers, and they confirm that the agency simply can't be trusted with such sweeping authority.
That's National Security Fellow Patrick Toomey with the American Civil Liberties Union, one of the groups that sued the government to force them to release this information to the public. One of the documents is a FISA court order from 2009 rebuking the NSA for collecting information about U.S. persons who are not under investigation. It says the FISA court was disturbed to discover thousands of violations by the government over several years, which they called systemic and ongoing. Attorney Jesselyn Radak with the Government Accountability Project said the issue she found most troubling in this declassified opinion is that the NSA routinely conducted illegal information searches in order to find probable cause to conduct legal ones.
It would be like the government breaking into your house so it could look for evidence that you might have committed some sort of illegal activity. The government can't commit a crime in order to look for evidence of another crime that it might want to charge you with. The government is supposed to have probable cause or at least a reasonable, articulable suspicion. NSA is sort of reverse engineering the process.
Last month, Reuters revealed that the NSA engaged in similar reverse engineering in a program that shared private surveillance information with the Drug Enforcement Agency. Radak told FSRN that Congress gave too much legal authority to the NSA during what she called the general hysteria following the 2001 terrorist attacks in New York, Washington, and Pennsylvania, including the Patriot Act, which was quickly passed by Congress just weeks after September 11th.
These programs that spy on Americans have nothing to do with protecting national security. Really, this is more about control of the citizenry and a surveillance. This turned our country into a surveillance state, and that completely violate the First and Fourth Amendment.
As many lawmakers gave speeches Wednesday calling for the U.S. to remain vigilant 12 years after the September 11th attacks, Democratic Senators Ron Wyden of Oregon and Mark Udall of Colorado released a joint statement saying the declassified documents provide further evidence that the NSA's bulk data collection is needless and should be ended. Further privacy violations were revealed Wednesday in The Guardian, based on documents leaked by former NSA contractor Edward Snowden. One document, a memorandum of understanding between the NSA and Israel's surveillance agency, called the INSU, indicates the two countries have been sharing the private data of American citizens. David Green with the Electronic Frontier Foundation says he's concerned about the lack of any legally binding limits on how Israel uses that data.
And this agreement says they're told that it's subject to minimization procedures and that there's certain information they're not permitted to access. And it says that, you know, Israeli agents will need to be trained to understand what they can't touch. The agreement just says, well, we'll have to figure out training in the future. And there's no enforcement mechanism in here.
The memorandum says Israel can retain any files containing the identities of U.S. persons for up to a year, but they're required to destroy upon recognition any communication to or from an official of the U.S. government, including staff and members of the White House, cabinet departments, independent agencies, the House of Representatives, and the Senate, as well as the federal courts, including the Supreme Court. The documents do not confirm or deny whether the NSA has ever spied on any of these branches of government or passed their communications to Israel. Alice Olstein, Free Speech Radio News, Washington.
That's it for today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Kopp. Headlines editor was Jess Burns. Our Washington, D.C. correspondent, Alice Olstein. Our technical production team at KPFA Berkeley is Janine Etter and Shauna Ray. Our theme music was composed and produced by Alan Weatherhead. Teddy Wilson manages our Tumblr page, where you can find sights and sounds from FSRN's Global Reporters. We welcome your questions, comments, and news tips. Write to us, comments@fsrn.org. For more news stories, specials, and our documentaries, visit our website, fsrn.org, and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/fsrn. Thanks for listening. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina.